So what I wanted to kind of as an introduction, I think, to this whole concept that we're trying to do here, and to try to kind of weave together a little bit the legal the secular legal system and Jewish kosher mishpat law, is I think I want to give a little background maybe and give a few examples where you find that our halachas, even business halachas, kosher mishpat halachas, you can't separate the religious part of it from the chosha mishpah, from the business legal ramifications part of it. So you can't just say, well, look, in shul and when it comes to ritual stuff, that's when Judaism plays a role, and then, you know, everything else, let me leave that on the side. So there's a few examples, there's lots of examples, but I just chose three examples where we'll see. I think it's really interesting that our set of ethical and moral and halachic standing is going to actually play a role in how it's legally binding in Beis Din. And as our legal system takes into account kind of a moral behavior system and takes into account religion, okay? And takes that into account into the actual halacha system of Beis Din and how that's enforceable in court. Certain times, so you know, a lot of times, you know, I would imagine in a regular legal scenario, very few people come and ask the question: Was I allowed to do what I did? Am I right, or was I right for doing what I did? Or was wrong? It's more like, what's my obligation at this point? You know, someone will say, well, look, you drove on the wrong side of the street. You shouldn't have done that, but you don't have to pay for the damage. Okay, so then, I'm potter. You know, I'm off the hook. I don't have to pay for the damage I caused. It doesn't make a difference. I was right or I was wrong. You know, and that's not like that when you're dealing within a Jewish legal system. A lot has to do with, were you allowed to do that or not? Are you correct? You're incorrect. Is it the correct way to behave? Is it the right thing to do? So I'm going to give a few examples and to bring out the point that I'm saying. One example, we're actually giving a shiur on this topic in North Miami Beach. We're giving a shiur every Sunday on the topic. And it's an interesting topic because the source for the topic is a pasuk in the Chumash. The pasuk in the Chumash says, "Va'asisa hayashar va'atov." You are supposed to do that which is straight and good. All right, then I'll be an upstanding guy. Fine. So I'm going to do the right thing. Now, objectively, the right thing. Now, someone comes to court and says, well, this guy, he didn't do the right thing. Okay, so, you know, he could learn. How's that a claim? You know, you didn't do the right thing. Is that a claim if there's no monetary, recourse on that? Right? So one litigant will tell the other, you know, well, in front of court, look, he was wrong. He didn't do the right thing. Okay, well, how does that put him, how's that a claim on a monetary claim? But here's an example. So the Torah says, Asisa hayashar v'atov. You have to do the right and the just thing. Now, the Gemara teaches us the following halacha. If someone is selling a property, and we're learning this on the Sunday morning class, if someone is putting up a property for sale, and the neighbor would like to purchase the property, an outside person, you know, either lives in the community and likes the house, or he's maybe moving in from out of town, or whatever it may be. Someone else wants to come in and purchase that home. The halacha is that the neighbor has the right of first refusal on the home. What's the source for that? Did he buy it? Did he pay for that right? How did he get that right of first refusal on the home to be able to purchase the home before anybody else? How does the neighbor have that right? So the Gemara says, from this pasuk, Asisa hayashar v'atov, you're supposed to do the right thing. That means the potential buyer, he can buy a house anywhere. He's got the money, he can buy a house anywhere. Why does he have to go ahead and buy specifically the house that's next door to this guy? And this guy has an advantage to buy the house that's next door to him because he wants to expand his home, he wants to have a bigger yard, he wants to be able to host guests, whatever he may want to do with that home. Okay?
Can I ask a question? Actually, I have two questions. The first is,
questions are always welcome.
Well, I just want to make sure. For the first question is, suppose there's a shortage of housing.
Okay.
So therefore, your presumption that he could buy any home
good
is not correct, especially that's, like in your community, you have
I will
you have certain you have Arab and you have certain facilities for Orthodox residents that are not
excellent
commonly
point
found. Second question is, doesn't the right of first refusal place a chilling effect on the value of the homes? Because any buyer knows that, whatever offer they make is subject to being matched, and therefore it's not no longer freely alienable. Wouldn't that put lessen the marketability and value of the home?
Okay, so I'll say two things to Bob's points. It sounds like you should be coming to the Sunday morning class because I'm going to try to summarize the whole topic. I'm going to be giving about 6 or 7 like an hour long classes on this topic itself. So I'm trying to summarize it now in about 15 minutes.
Okay.
So, but all your points you're making I want to bring all the points you're making are exactly discussed, and discussed. Exactly the way you're making the points. Number one is, does the seller have to lose now because of that? We're talking about asisa yasharato, do the right thing. So that's not from the perspective of the buyer. The buyer, why should he go ahead and buy a house on top, and take away the opportunity of a neighbor where he could expand, go get somewhere else? But is that at the expense of the seller? I mean, maybe the yasharato is that the seller should get the money he can get for the house. Okay, and we actually say that it's not when it's going to be at the expense of the seller. So, for example, let's say you're selling a portfolio. You have 10 properties for sale, and one neighbor comes up and says, "I want property A." Okay, but you're not buying property B, C, D, E, or F, right? So, and if now I'm going to give the opportunity for the neighbor to pop up on each of the properties, so no one's going to buy that portfolio. So that issue is brought up on an individual property. It's considered to be that he'll be able to get his price. So
I
don't agree with
that thing. It does chill it a little bit. No, I never thought. I mean, maybe I missed last week, so that's why you said it. But it does seem to chill it, doesn't it? Because nobody's going to make an offer.
Well,
you're never going to get to the market rate because you don't know what a willing buyer would really give, but for the lien that's on there from the.
I think it's the opposite.
Example. You can always trade them out if you're the higher price already.
But he's not
for sure off the market.
He knows the buyer has
right.
the
buyer has a right to match it. So that's one thing. The second thing is, before I bid, I want to get more information about the house. So I may send in an inspector. I may do a lien search. I may,
Well, at that point, the buyer.
I need more information. So I'm going to invest time, effort, and money, knowing that there's a right that someone could take
pull the contract
away from me.
Yeah.
I'm not willing to make that investment in acquiring the information.
Well, obviously the neighbor would have to reimburse the potential buyer for all of his expenses he incurred during the process. That's correct. But
so then you are putting it on the neighbor. So now the neighbor has to...
Not the owner. I'm saying the neighbor who wants to buy it would have to reimburse the potential buyer who already put in money and say, well, if I want to take your position in the contract, then he has to reimburse him for all of his expenses that he put in to get that contract.
Yeah, but I mean, in the practical world, I mean, you have a volatile housing...
I mean, I've been involved in just a few years, the last couple of years, in 3-4 such cases that the Beis Din did award the neighbor the house.
No,
and
I'm
it worked.
Not, I'm not saying it's not a valid principle. I'm just saying that it has consequences.
Well, look. So here's the booklet. So there's a lot of stuff written on this. So this is the issue. But a lot of your points are and the truth is, when you look at the poskim, when you look at the literature written on it, so you kind of could tell, that some of them would prefer to limit the right of the neighbor, and some of them would prefer to expand the right of the neighbor. It really depends on your perspective. Some people seem to believe that giving him more rights is more correct, and some say, well, it's going to limit the ability of the market to be free, and we rather limit it to more limited cases. Okay, but
statistically, it does when someone has a right of first refusal, it does place a chilling effect on the value of the home, because it's no longer an auction type of market. It's a situation where
There are going to be limitations, and it's going to be to the assumption that the neighbor is going to pay the price. So he could put in, he's going to match the offer, and it's not going to be to the detriment of the seller at that point. So why
couldn't you do something else, for instance? Why couldn't you say, okay, the neighbor wants to buy it, and this other guy wants to buy it. So what we're going to do is we're going to auction the house off. We're going to give no preference neither to the buyer nor to the neighbor or to the third party buyer. We're going to auction the house off, and whoever bids the highest price gets.
Well, that's probably essentially what's going to end up happening.
Well, but why don't you actually do that?
Well, you don't do that because you don't do that because that could be taking advantage. That could be unfairly raising the price against the neighbor.
No, where it's an auction. Anyone could come and.
Well, that's really what every sale is more or less. Ultimately nowadays, there is a discussion what happens if he's getting his asking price. There's a lot of discussions on this. It's a long topic, and like I said, I'm giving like 6 or 7 classes on it to discuss the parameters. But I wanted to bring out a point, okay? And the point was that there's no source for this right of first refusal. The neighbor, when he bought the house, didn't pay to get that ability. And yet, where do we learn it from? It's an understood concept that Chazal learned from Asisa Yashar HaTov. Asisa Yashar HaTov, it sounds like a very general, statement in the Chumash. Do the right thing. But our Chazal told us there's specific applications. And one of them is this. One of them is, when you're buying a house, let the neighbor go first. So you say, okay, you know what? I don't want to let the neighbor go first. I'm not such a nice guy. You expect me to be a nice guy. All right, look, I'm not such a nice guy. And he went in and bought the house. The right of the neighbor is there even after the purchase is made. And obviously, closing costs would have to be covered, etc. But the neighbor can take the buyer to the Beis Din. And at the Beis Din, he can now get the home even after, post facto, after it was already purchased. That means that the obligation to be a nice guy is enforceable in court.
Otherwise, you have essentially a right of specific performance.
Yeah, but it's not a right that you purchased or paid for. It's the obligation, a communal social obligation that we understand that the buyer should be, quote unquote, a nice guy. He should be yashar and tov. He should be straight, and the Beis Din will enforce that on him and say, look, you are not yashar and tov. You have to give him that. So it's an application where a moral obligation is actually being enforced in court. It's not like, well, look, I wasn't a nice guy, but do I owe you money? Did I steal from you? Did I do anything to you? Did I take your property? Did I damage you? No. So what's the problem? So it's a fascinating example of, where taking a moral value and enforcing it in the basis.
If it's a moral value, don't you have to look behind the neighbor's motivation to buy the house?
So yes, you do. No. If he's going to buy it and flip it, if he's going to buy it and flip it to someone else, the Beis Din will not honor that. The Beis Din will not honor that.
Well, how do they know? Maybe he has a secret intention.
Okay, I mean, look, we gotta work with what we're given,
That's what I'm saying.
So you're talking about flipping the house. It comes to Beis Din and say, I want the house, I want to buy it. That would be a...
Right. Exactly. You have to assume, we're going to go with what he's claiming. We're going to go with the purpose of, he's saying that he wants it to expand. He wants to build a bigger house. He wants to have a bigger yard. He wants to be able to host guests.
I understand all that. That's a moral reason.
So that's what I'm saying. But it's a case where we're actually going to enforce it in court. That's what I thought was unique about the case. But
I was just saying, just what it seems like you're saying is that in Jewish law, they're trying to make the person a more moral person. And in secular law, they're just trying to keep everybody off each other's throat. I'm not trying to make you a better person.
Right. I'm not going to enforce a position on you because where the position is coming from a place of, do the right thing. Do the right thing when I want to do the right thing, and when I don't want to, then, if I didn't damage you, then I'm not going to do the right thing. So I think that was an interesting application. There's There's a
Mom's question is really quick. When they require that it's not for reinvestment, is that ever in writing, or is that just something they say, make a commitment to us? It's not.
I'm sure that if, let's say, the guy already has emails written to someone else and said, like, hey, once I get a hold of the house, I'm sure that they would look into that.
You don't know what's in someone's mind.
You don't know what's in someone's mind, that's for sure.
Intention to take advantage of the situation.
Discover it.
But anybody
can discover it.
Excuse me?
Anyone can cheat. You can't
we have to expect we have to demand a certain level of honesty.
I'm just saying,
is there a discovery? There's discovery, but discovery gets a little tricky in Basin because they don't have access to as many documents. They don't have to enforce it is much more difficult. The court really has enforceability powers on that much better. They can force leverage it. They can't leverage in Basin. It's much harder to leverage that.
Can people sign an arbitration agreement?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So under that arbitration agreement,
they would then go to court to get the discovery. That's the only way to do it.
Yeah. My only point was, if you're enforcing a moral right, then the motivation behind it is important.
Correct, 100%.
As opposed to in commercial law, the motivation is irrelevant.
Correct. It's what's on the paper, and that's it. Right.
And you have to do your due diligence regardless.
Yeah.
To make sure.
You know. So I'll give you one other example. Pass it around. So I'll give you another example where there's a moral obligation, but in this case it's not enforceable in Basin. It's considered wrong, but it's not necessarily enforceable in Basin. Okay? So that's a case, we just had a class on it. This was another one. I'll show you afterwards. You know, this is a class that we had given, but it's very interesting. Was that, you know, there what happens is this follows. Someone made a verbal commitment to either purchase a property or to go into a deal or even to hire someone. Okay? So he made a verbal agreement with not signing anything, right? Which is obviously, you know, legally not binding at all. But they agreed to that. Handshake, no handshake. There was an agreement, a verbal agreement. So in this case, it's considered objectively wrong and incorrect and even prohibited to go back against your word. But in that case, it's not enforceable in court.
Well, why not?
Well, because Bezdin is, at that point, since there was no formal acquisition made, the Bezdin is not going to enforce it, but they will, quote-unquote, they will basically claim that they would encourage the person to continue with his word. They would say it's wrong for you to go against your word. They would say, if you go against your word, we are going to publicly announce that you're a dishonest person.
Right, right.
But it can't. That level is not enforceable in court.
Under secular law, first of all, a promise doesn't have to be in writing. If it could be performed within a year. But secondly, suppose the person comes into court. I mean, I assume it's like an evidentiary issue that it's not specifically definite enough to be enforced. Suppose the person comes into before the Bezdin and they're asked to swear an oath. And they admit, yeah, I did make this promise. I certainly did promise to do this. And he's absolutely right. I did promise.
But I changed my mind.
But now, you know, I decided that I got a better deal elsewhere. So why wouldn't it be enforceable then? There's no doubt that he entered into it.
Because he didn't make a formal acquisition. Nothing formally happened. He promised him he'll do it. And it's going to be considered the wrong thing to do. It's the wrong thing to do, and it's even prohibited to do that from a religious perspective. But in that case, we can't enforce it because there was no formal acquisition made. Okay, so that's the point where that's an example where, you know, there is a moral threshold that
maybe
he reached.
Maybe that's why in secular law it's still enforceable, because there is no such thing as right but still prohibited.
Right. So, but why is it enforceable? I thought everything has to be kind of, you reach the contract or whatever.
Well, if there was a meeting of minds and it's not on, like Bob saying, within a year, certain things are excluded, sale of land, then it's enforceable. But there's no such thing as, like, there's a middle ground in a law, but you're still doing
good. You're still doing good or not good, but we could enforce it, can't enforce it. That's where, you know, so there's going to be a whole sugya of how wrong is it.
I don't understand the reason why they wouldn't enforce it if there's no dispute as to whether or not the promise was made.
Because the promise is between, at that point, is a religious obligation for you. Now, it could be considered, did the guy get damages from it? Was, is you know... But at the end of the day, it's not going to be enforceable, and it's not going to be permitted.
Why do you need like an extra thing?
You need a kinyan because
why do you need a kinyan halacha as opposed to just if we know the promise is made, that's
because it's still mine. I told you I'll do it. I'll hire you. I told you I'll hire you, but until I hire you, then it's not complete.
You told me you're going to hire me, so I moved my family down from New York. I bought a house here.
Right, so,
and spent a lot of money. And now I come to you and say, well, I'm not hiring you.
Unfortunately,
you know what?
I'm sure legally, you know, you could fire, it's hire and fire, so, you know. But
you would be responsible in halacha, wouldn't you?
I think you would be responsible in halacha in a case where you gave up another job for it.
Yeah.
You know, but.
Otherwise, like the promissory estoppel, kind of.
If you gave up another opportunity for it, then yes.
What would this guy be?
Grama.
I'm saying, what could you be hiring him? I said, I'll give you a job, so now I have to hire you for how, like...
No, you have to give me the money I lost, probably.
Yeah. Have you had situations where Jews will have non-Jews purchase the home so they can get around this? Because if a non-Jew is purchasing the home...
Correct.
Then there's no... So have you... Basically, has people...
No.
To that?
No. I have had a case that someone came over to me and said that a neighbor wants the house, but the neighbor doesn't want to go to the seller and ask him, would he sell it to me? Because he knows that he's going to overcharge him.
Right.
So this friend of mine says, I was asked by the neighbor to go and ask the owner, how much are you going to buy? But really, I have no interest in buying it. I'm just asking so that now the neighbor could put a contract on that asking price. You understand? So he said, is that on? And that, the whole thing is Yoshev HaToiv, and now I'm lying on that, you know?
I'm
yeah, when would the time be to and buying the house. There are so many variables. Suppose the says, I want to buy it, I don't have the cash, I need finance. Is the seller obligated?
No, again, because that's going to be at the expense of the seller.
The owner of the house.
If the seller would prefer to sell cash,
the terms have to be...
No, but if the seller, if the other buyer's a guy, then he doesn't have to listen to Yoshev HaToiv.
No.
It's not on the seller, it's on the buyer. It's the whole chi of Yoshev HaToiv is on the buyer, not the seller.
No, but the neighbor, he should still sell it to the neighbor first as he did.
It's not on the seller, it's on the buyer. I mean, the buyer should leave, but it's the seller has no obligation. It's the rule of, you know. So I thought that those were two examples of where there's a moral responsibility, where we would enforce it. In one case, we wouldn't. But regardless, there's a level of moral which is going to be expected, which is going to say you can't go past that. And Bezdin will enforce morality in terms of an ethical advantage to the person. So I thought that was an interesting application where I think we see a very big difference between, you know, what's unique about a halacha, where you can't just say, well, you know, bottom line, did I pay for it? Do I not? You know, the morality will come in. We could talk more about. I can come in. We can give a whole class just on that if you want, but just on that topic of bar mitzvah. I've been learning it now for like 3-4 months. It's really interesting. But I want to. There's another example which I think, if you're getting excited about the first example, you're not going to leave me alone on this one.
No,
but listen to this.
I'm just curious.
No, it's great. The next example is wild. Okay, it's where you're going to see. As religious people, there's a big factor that we have to take into account when we're going to deal with a legal question, which is the role of God. In where does Hashem play a role over here? Where does God play a role when we're dealing with one another, with a business deal? And it's unbelievable that what we're going to see here, what the example is, which again I think only applies in a religious system, obviously. Okay, so. Let's just the following again. I can give a whole set of classes on this, but just to keep it very, very simple. Okay, this was very relevant in COVID times, when basically what was going on was when people had agreements to hire, to rent out apartments, to rent out, you know, a wedding hall, and then they had to cancel. Everything was being canceled because of COVID, because of the pandemic. So you may have hired a teacher or a babysitter for your child, and now you're not going to work. You don't need the babysitter.
Right, because the cancel of the
Okay, so there's also wedding halls, there's rental, Pesach, you know, that Pesach, that year, everything was canceled, and people had rented homes for the holiday. So, this was like a topic. There was, what's the idea? The idea basically is that the case in the Gemara, we like to try and find sources for everything in the Gemara. So the case in the Gemara is someone had rented leased a property, and the arrangement in those in the times of the Gemara was one arrangement you could make was he leased the property for the purpose of planting wheat, and he was going to pay his rental fee was going to be a set amount of wheat, 2 pallets of wheat. That's what he was going to pay the owner. He works, whatever. Turns out, locusts, some sort of crazy, unexpected a grain disease hits the farm, and he doesn't produce any wheat. Okay, oinus, like you said, it's not his fault. Does he have to pay the rent, or does he not have to pay the rent? He did his job, but on the other hand, he has nothing to show for it. So does he have to pay, or does he not have to pay? Maybe he has to go to the store, get the 2 pallets of wheat, and pay the rent, even though he didn't produce it. So the Gemara says it depends. The Gemara says, if all the fields in that area were hit by the same disease, then we say that he doesn't have to pay. Because we presume that it's not his fault. It's a makas medina. It's something that hit everyone equally. It was beyond the scope of their agreement. And therefore, he's not obligated to pay because he can't meet his obligation due to something which is way beyond his control. And therefore, as makas medina, he does not have to pay the rent. You don't have to go and buy wheat elsewhere. But let's say none of the other fields in the area were hit with this, and only this particular field was hit with that particular disease. Now, we're not saying he didn't do his hygiene. I mean, that's not what we're saying. It was an oinus. It was completely out of his control. But the thing only, the locust or whatever happened only hit his field. So now, does he have to pay or not? You would think it's the same thing. So here we say, no, there he has to pay. Even though it was also completely out of his control. Why? So Rashi says, mazlo garam. It's his mazel. So we love to say mazel tov, you have a good mazel. But we say it was the mazel. Here, mazel is actually going to be a legal, we're going to try to determine the mazel to determine the legal ramifications of does he have to pay or not? Whose fault is it? Whose fault is it? Something which it was out of everyone's control, but it was your mazel clearly. Hashem took away the grain from you. He didn't take it away from the boss. If you would have taken it away from everyone equally, it's one thing. But he took it away from you, no one else. It's clearly your mazel. It's considered your fault. If it's considered your fault, you got to pay the owner. That's what that's the halacha. It's a fascinating idea. But this is how far it goes. Okay? Let's say there's an entire Makas Medina. So in other words, this disease hit all the fields in that area. Okay? So he has fields in Nebraska, in this plot. All the fields in that area were hit with this disease. But this tenant, this farmer, in addition to the fields in Nebraska that he also has 7 fields out in Alabama. And his 7 fields in Alabama got the same disease. So here the Gemara says we would also say it's the mazel of the tenant, because you were affected because of your mazel, because you were affected with disease even if it weren't for everyone else's fault, because your 7 fields in Alabama were hit with this disease. So again, we're going to play it as your mazel comes in, and what we say is, oh, Hashem's decision was to take away the grain from you, not from me, you as the tenant.
What if he has another 7 fields in Florida that didn't get hit?
Okay, no, it has to be Kulam.
Why?
Because then you can't attribute it to his mazel necessarily. Because if he had fields that were saved,
he doesn't know how to get one as opposed to.
All he 7. Does, but how do you can't? But now the landlord can't prove that it's his mazel, because maybe it was the landlord's mazel. It's only considered a proof to his mazel if all of the tenant's fields were hit with the same disease. But what's my point in saying that? So it's an unbelievable concept, right? It means it wasn't his fault, and no one's claiming it's his fault. But the landlord can come in and say, it's your fault from a religious perspective. Look, Hashem had something against you this year, and your mazel hit, and therefore it's not going to, don't blame me. I gave you, I produced you for you a field that was could have produced the grain theoretically, but we're going to say that you have to pay the rent. Okay, so now the application of this came up, for example, where you had a strip mall and they closed down this store. So does he have to put? Does he have to? Now you could say, well, look.
Close down the anchor tenant. They closed down the anchor tenant.
What's the anchor tenant?
The main tenant of the plaza.
Okay, maybe. Okay, so what the claims were, look, I gave you a storefront that you could have used for an essential use. You happen to be, I remember I'm saying this because this was a case I dealt. You happen to be a karate, you teach karate. This guy teaches karate, this Israeli guy. He was telling me this, what happened. You happen to teach karate, it's not considered an essential use, and therefore they closed you down. So the landlord says, it's not my mazel, because, I have a perfectly fine storefront. It's your mazel because you own the store that they closed down. They didn't close down food stores. They didn't close down X, Y, and Z. You could have opened up a bakery there and rented it from me, and you would have stayed open. So it's the mazel of the karate guy. It's not the mazel of the landlord. What?
It's not apples to apples. The guy with the weed could have done something else
This is a grain field. What do you mean?
But he could have planted soybeans.
Right. For the same reason that he says you could have done other than karate, the landlord could have told him.
No. Because here the arrangement is giving you wheat.
And here the arrangement is I want to.
I don't care what you. The landlord doesn't care what store you put in there.
Yeah, but
the landlord doesn't care. He's not getting a percentage of your. He's not getting a percentage of your grain or anything like that. He rented it out to you. Go do what you want.
There wasn't anything in the contract that said what it was going
to
be used.
You're saying, let's say he would say in the middle, I'm going to change it to a bakery. Would he have to get approval? Probably. What do you mean?
No, but taking your hypothetical, so there's a wheat famine, and so the guy plants sunflower seeds, and he gets a good crop, takes it to market, earns some money, and goes out and buys 2 bushels of wheat and gives it to the landlord.
He can do that. He can do that technically, but at that point, surely if there's going to be a sunflower seed disease, he's going to be out. Right?
The point is
he's not going to have any claim.
The point is that. In secular law, we would call that like force majeure.
Right.
But if there's a way to avoid the loss, then you can't apply force majeure in secular.
So that's maybe that was okay. So that I'm saying it's not that different. It's really, but the factor that we're bringing in the mazel, I think, is a fascinating idea.
Well, force majeure is different because force majeure is like it applies to everyone. This is saying if it's your force majeure, it's your problem.
Right. It's your industry.
I mean, the way I see it is that you're. Imputing into the contract, the intervention of
God. That's what I'm trying to say.
And that God
took away the deal from you. That's what I'm trying to bring out.
And this person, a famine, and therefore he couldn't. And why should it be my fault when you did something to incur God's wrath?
That's what I'm trying to say. That's exactly the point. So I think that wouldn't go anywhere in secular court, right? So no, but
it's a special shelf for people.
Yeah, tell that to the judge.
So it's a. I'm saying it's.
I'll ask him the judge to write a writ of Rachmanis.
There's a fascinating application of it. I'm going to take it even a step further. This is unbelievable.
So did the guy win?
What?
So the guy was able to make that argument?
In Besdin? I don't know what happened in Besdin. I don't remember exactly the outcome. But
the fact that the case existed.
Yeah, it was a case right here. It was on 160. It's on 19th Avenue and Miami Gardens Drive. I was giving shit with this guy, and we were learning this topic, and he was like, "Hey, I'm in the middle of a case about this," and I thought it was really interesting because it's really this example. There's
what happens if someone has a right, say in Besdin, and they realize that if I go to Besdin, I'm going to lose, but in secular court, I'm going to win. And so they forego Besdin, they go into secular court, like the situation with the land. So they go into secular court, they are able to transact the business with the third party, could Beis Din still take jurisdiction over the case and assert itself?
So it depends. Why did they go to court? Did he circumvent Beis Din? Did he not? I mean legally speaking, the money. If he has no rights to the money from a halachic Beis Din perspective, then the money's not considered his. It's considered stolen money. Mm-hmm. It's considered. Rabbi Akiva Eiger says it's considered stolen money, and it's not considered his money. Can't be conversation with that money. Takes it in court versus Beis Din. So it's not, there's certain cases where the Beis Din will, as a punitive measure, will kind of say, look, you guys circumvented, now it's better for you to come back here. They may not want to take that case. Right. But that's, technically speaking, they should be able to come back in and take the case. There's even a claim in that sugya of the grain, the following claim, which is wild. But the claim is that, let's say there was a famine, a disease, a grain disease in the entire area on wheat. Now this guy, they made up to plant wheat, but he decided to go ahead and plant barley. And his barley also got hit with the disease. So the landlord, what's the landlord's claim here? His claim seems pretty weak. Because what's his claim? The barley, look, I was hit. But even if I had planted wheat, it would have been hit. Because everyone else who planted wheat in the area also got hit. But there's no proof that had you planted wheat, it would have gotten hit. Maybe not. So Rashi says, now this is really crazy. But Rashi says in the Gemara, and I heard a whole shiur about this before Hashanah. Rashi claims that he says, I spent my entire Rosh Hashanah praying that my wheat should be saved from the famine. And you went ahead and planted barley, so my prayers weren't heard. God would have saved my wheat. Trust me, I'm a big tzaddik. God could have saved my wheat. You went ahead and used and planted barley. So you can't prove to me that had it been dependent on my mazel would have been hit. You have no proof to that. So in that case, the landlord wins. Means if the tenant went against the agreed upon deal, even if the agreed upon deal also got hit by that that disease, since it wasn't proven that it was his fault, he's allowed to claim that his chus would have been strong enough to merit having been saved from the disease. So my point in saying this is again. This is not everyone agrees to that. That's Rashi's opinion. But Rambam says differently. But my point is that like you said, go tell the judge. When you're dealing in a religious legal system, you can't ignore the religious part of the legal system. God plays a role, and we have to think about how that plays out into it. The morality plays a role. So Yashav Atov, so be a nice guy, may not just be a nice guy. Be a nice guy means we can enforce that being a nice guy, that's like the background in terms of a lot of these.
I would say in a general sense, the law tries to follow what's considered to be the morals of society, to enforce what's considered to be moral behavior. It's not just arbitrary.
No, but they would never take into account things like this.
No, of course.
Your prayer or things like that, because that's alien to society.
You didn't do what you were intended to render for.
They're not trying to transform the person into a better person.
You broke contract.
They're trying to say morality.
Right, but it's not consequential.
It's more of a social thing.
I mean, but it is.
It's more of a social, societal thing, right. To try to keep the society straight, but as far as actually, like you're saying, seeing that each person is doing their responsibility, that's not the issue necessarily. There's one idea that the Chazon Ish writes, so and it's good to share in this context. Chazon Ish writes that he says, kind of what you mentioned from a Torah perspective, but he says, let's say a person wants to say, I don't know much Torah. But I have good midos. I have good character. I'm a nice guy. Chazon Ish says it's very difficult to be nice if you don't know the law. because you may not know who you're supposed to be nice to. Right? He gives a perfect example. He says, there's one guy owns a pizza shop on First Avenue. Another guy wants to open a pizza shop on Second Avenue. Right. And that bothers you to no end, because the First Avenue pizza shop guy has been there for 40 years. He's your friend. You go there for all your kids' birthdays and everything. And this guy, Second Avenue, who does this guy think he is, coming in from wherever, some random state up north, and he's coming in from here and deciding to like open up, a pizza shop. Who is this guy think he is? And it bothers you. So you think that to be a nice guy, you're going to protect the first guy. Right? And make sure that he retains his parnasa, he retains it. Right? So the Chazon Ish says, hold on. We first have to determine what's the law. Does the second person have a right to open or not? So he says, the only way you could be nice is if you know the law. If the law is that the second person is not allowed to open, then you're correct. Then the way to be, then you should be nice by making sure to protect the first one. But if the law says the second person is allowed to open, so then the way to be nice is to help him open. He's permitted to do that. So if the law dictates he's permitted to, then by trying to shut him down, you're not being a nice guy, you're being a mean guy. Because I'm allowed to open a store, so why are you shutting me down for? So therefore, the determination of how to be morally correct depends on the law. You can't be a morally correct person because you may not know what's, how to apply that. So Chazon Ish says there's no objective nice guy, or there's no objective character until you really know the law. Then you can apply your character with the right people in the right way. Otherwise, you could be totally misusing, your midos, your character. So it's also, it's another point where you have to kind of mix in the character with the law, and this goes the other way around. First, we were talking about that the character may dictate the law, but the law also dictates the character. They go together. So from our perspective, everything goes together. You can't divorce one from the other. So I think that's, the message, pretty much.
Very good.
All right?
Okay.